Tunter Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Bucket to Greece, Volume 2, by V.D. Bucket. Narrated by David Vickery. Chapter 1. Lost to the Shredder. After a morning spent grappling with the complexities of the three Greek genders, my brain was reduced to mush. Whilst it was perfectly logical that the declinable article preceding the name of my good friend Spiros was masculine, I struggled to get to grips with the concept of random things such as bunches of spinach, bicycles, and egg cups having assigned sexes. It was all terribly confusing. It had just been drilled into me during class that, linguistically, a sheep was male. But what if I happened across a ewe in my stroll through the village? Should I address it as male or female? I couldn't even pick Marigold's brain since she'd skipped our weekly Greek lesson in favour of her monthly get-together with the Greek ladies of the village to beautify the cemetery. These meetings appeared to involve rather more coffee-drinking and gossip than actual weeding, but provided a great opportunity for my wife to develop new friendships in the community of Melli. The mountain village of Melli had been our new home since upping sticks from Manchester to a new life in the sun almost 3 months ago, and we were keen to integrate into village life. Carrying my pile of completely indecipherable Greek textbooks into my new home office, I was shocked to catch my brother-in-law, Barry, engaged in an act of wanton destruction. Rushing forward, I attempted to stop him from feverishly feeding the first 40 pages of my painstakingly penned Moving Abroad manuscript into the shredder.
"I have to do it, Victor. It's for your own good,"
the sheepish-looking Barry said.
"Are you crazy?"
I shouted.
"Marigold made me do it,"
Barry confessed, looking contrite.
"Anyway, she may have a point. Do you really suppose anyone would be riveted by your account of Marigold's difficulties in locating a foreign lavatory that is more than a hole in the floor, or in the long-winded descriptions of hygiene violations that you detected on the ferry over to Patras?"
"You're the one who advised me to make it authentic and pad it out with lots of details of local colour and customs," I remonstrated, seizing hold of the wad of paper in a desperate attempt to prevent it from being chewed to ribbons. The shredder gobbled its way through the pages, rendering my efforts futile. Quite amazing, considering it was the only electrical appliance we'd brought over from England that still seemed to be working on the Greek two-prong circuit.
"I'm sorry, Victor, but I promised Marigold I'd get rid of it. She complained that you'd portrayed her in a most unflattering light,"
Barry apologized.
"But the whole point of me dragging out the old bucket name as a pseudonym is so that no one can identify us if the book becomes a runaway bestseller," I argued. "Marigold would retain her anonymity."
"Perhaps you should switch your nom de plume to Burke. Now it transpires that the woman who abandoned you in a bucket as a baby turns out to be a person named Violet Burke," Barry suggested. "If she ever turns up here, she's got a lot to answer for. Fancy saddling you with the unfortunate initials of V.D. with their disease-riddled connotations."
"It's a good job you were adopted and name changed quickly, though there's not much to choose between being a bucket or a Burke. I suppose you could add the whole sorry saga to the book, though. It would make an engrossing storyline."
"I cannot believe you think that the heartless woman who abandoned me in a bucket should be used as cheap fodder for mass entertainment,"
I protested. "Probably best to wait and see if she actually turns up as she threatened," Barry conceded.
"It could be a bit difficult to pad out her character since you've never actually met her."
Ignoring Barry's flippant lack of tact, I fingered the ripped shreds of paper, lamenting,
"But all those wasted hours agonizing over the perfect words to put on the page, now lost forever."
"Well, it's not as if you have to give up on the idea of writing a book. Just start again fresh and make it read less like a critical report you've penned for the Food Standard Agency. Marigold says you still haven't gotten the hang of using exclamation marks instead of full stops. But if you keep at it, you might pick up the style."
Marigold's obsession with Moving Abroad books had left her with a misguided impression that the pages ought to be indiscriminately littered with superfluous exclamation marks. In truth, I'd be as likely to take literary advice from my wife as I would from the cat.
I decided I would start over, but keep the manuscript well hidden from my wife's prying eyes and the cat's destructive claws.
How did Marigold persuade you to do her dirty work for her?
I asked, reflecting that perhaps the book would be improved if I made it more Greek-centric and dispensed with the intimate details of my leaving do that marked the close of my illustrious career as a public health inspector. Perhaps including the speech I gave was a tad unnecessary. I decided to take a pragmatic approach. I would rewrite the book, and at least the pile of shredded paper would serve as much-needed mulch for the compost heap.
She threatened that if I didn't destroy it, she'd show Cynthia the photographs of me with that haircut,
Barry confessed.
Not the mullet, I cried, wide-eyed with horror that my wife would resort to such devious blackmail tactics to get her brother to do her bidding.
Marigold played really dirty. She threatened to show the mullet one with a moustache. Barry winced. It wasn't a pleasant recollection. Even though he had insisted at the time that it was the height of fashion, the tacky mullet and moustache combined to make him look a real plonker.
I can see why you gave in to her blackmail. It's a bit early in your relationship for Cynthia to be confronted with the most embarrassing images of your past when you're still trying to make a good impression.
It's good of you to be so understanding, Barry said in relief. It was impossible to fall out with my brother-in-law, even if he had just shredded my literary masterpiece.
Barry had flown over from England, ostensibly to visit us, but in reality using us as an excuse to spend time with Cynthia, an Englishwoman living in Melli whom he'd met when he'd first driven us and our worldly goods over to Greece in one of his removal vans. It was obvious that the pair of them were head over heels. Since Marigold was keen to encourage the budding romance, in the hope that Barry would spend more time in Greece, it struck me as unlikely that she would follow through with her threat to flash an unbecoming picture of her moustached and mulleted brother in front of Cynthia. I decided to ask Marigold where she'd stashed the offending photo. It would amuse me to introduce it as a conversation starter with some of the elderly Greek widows in the village, who had taken rather a shine to Barry. It would, no doubt, prove helpful in expanding my Greek vocabulary to include the synonyms of frightful. I intended to spend the afternoon stuffing my brain with as many Greek food-related words as I could cram in preparation for the evening ahead. Earlier that morning, Marigold had popped into the village shop for some kurabiades, almond biscuits. She thought a crafty, decorative sprinkling of icing sugar may be enough to fool the ladies of the cemetery gathering into thinking they were homemade delicacies hot from her own oven. She returned from the shop with the dreadful news that Dina, one half of the couple that run the local taverna, had suffered the misfortune of falling off a haphazardly balanced olive tree ladder, breaking her arm in the process.
Not just any old arm either, but the one she favours when cooking, Marigold relayed.
Poor Nikos is at his wit's end, and is talking of having to close the taverna until she's got her arm back. He just can't manage alone, and his useless son Kostis is off on one of his hunting trips, chasing down wild boar.
Well, it makes a change from chasing women. That's terrible about Dina, though. Is she in much pain? I asked in genuine concern.
Dina was a delightful lady. She always had a warm smile on her face, despite her heavy workload helping Nikos in the fields and the taverna. It was a lot of work for a couple in their late 70s.
Nikos says she's muddling along. The hospital plastered her up and sent her home, but she can't cope with her usual kitchen duties. Nikos said at any other time of the year he'd likely manage, but now the nights are getting colder, it's his busiest time of year. The wood burner is a big draw. People can get warm without burning their way through their own log piles.
What bad luck that he must close and lose business, I commiserated, thinking I would sorely miss the opportunity to pop in if he's closed.
And you think that, Victor, which is why I volunteered your services to help out in the kitchen. You start this evening, Marigold announced.
You volunteered me, without even consulting me first, I gasped, mortified she had taken such a liberty. Really, Marigold,
I'm not sure my Greek culinary skills are so finely tuned that I can feed a room full of people. Nikos cooks the meat on the outdoor grill, Victor, as you well know. All you need to do is throw a few salads together and fry the chips, Marigold said impatiently.
It won't be easy living up to Dina's chips. They are without doubt the best I've ever tasted, Barry said, his face adopting a dreamy look.
I told Nikos you'd pop in late afternoon before he opens, because Dina can't manage to peel the potatoes without her arm. If she's up to it, she'll sit quietly by in the kitchen to give you a few pointers this evening, Marigold said.
That's sure to be helpful, as I can barely understand a word that she says,
I pointed out, my sarcasm lost on Marigold.
You are patently aware that Dina's taverna duties stretch to far more than simply tossing a few salads together. She also serves the food from the kitchen at the tables.
Yes, but it's not as though you'll need to take orders, Victor. It's not exactly fine dining with a choice of menu, Marigold snapped, reminding me that the staple taverna menu was bread, cheese, salad, and whatever Nikos grilled with fried potatoes.
Anyway, it'll be the perfect opportunity for you to practice your Greek. Since the customers won't be able to get away from you when you try to talk to them, you'll have a captive audience. Plus, you said you wanted something to occupy you now that you've retired. Something to bring in a bit of pocket money.
Look on the bright side, Barry piped up. You'll probably be on the same hourly rate as Guzim. I'll bring Cynthia along for dinner, shall I? It should be a hoot to see you in action.
Chapter 2 Burnt Sunshine. Marigold had really gone and landed me in it this time. The prospect of being responsible for preparing traditional Greek food and serving it to a taverna full of critical Greek locals certainly presented a challenge. When I'd mentioned I may fancy a little job in the future to occupy me on a part-time basis, I'd been thinking more along the lines of acting as a tour guide for British tourists holidaying in the area. I had an interesting stack of historical tomes on the Mani, which I intended to read my way through in order to present myself as a fount of local knowledge. New to early retirement, I was still enjoying the change of pace, my days no longer ruled by the list of restaurant and takeaway kitchens I'd been duty-bound to inspect in my glittering career as a public health inspector. Thus far, my new life in Greece had not seen me descend into idleness. My first month had been occupied with overseeing the work of Vangelis, a local builder, in modernizing the old village house we'd purchased from the local undertaker, Spiros, who had inherited it from his dead uncle. The overgrown garden presented an enormous challenge, but with the help of Guzim, the Albanian who lived in the stone shed at the bottom of the garden, the overgrowth was being restored to order, and the first vegetable seeds planted. Once the initial frenzy of activity associated with moving had abated, we began weekly Greek lessons, and I started to pen the now shredded book about our experiences moving to a new country. Not ready for the scrap heap quite yet, I fully intended to keep busy. My former career exposed me to some of the most disgustingly foul restaurant practices, inspecting insanitary and infestation-riddled establishments, the owners clearly negligent in their duties of abiding by strict hygiene regulations. Naturally, this left me suspicious of eating in restaurants where the kitchens remained unvetted by my experienced eye. The local taverna I was about to help out in featured a soot-stained ceiling festooned with dusty mosquito-clogged cobwebs. It had initially struck me as a filthy dump that would fail a health inspection miserably. Yet the food that emerged from Nikos's outside grill and Dina's archaic kitchen was the best I had ever tasted, everything being homegrown or reared for the grill. I soon realized that the filth was superficial, being limited mainly to the dining area. Dina may be a lovely woman with high standards of personal hygiene, yet she takes a very lax attitude to mopping and dusting. Fortunately, she does keep a clean enough kitchen, if not exactly scrupulously. Nevertheless, I reflected that if I was to help out in the taverna, it would have to be thoroughly scrubbed. I couldn't, in all conscience, compromise on my exacting standards and serve food prepared in
anything less than the most pristine hygienic conditions. Realizing a monumental task awaited, as soon as lunch with Marigold and Barry was finished, I raided my stock of rubber gloves, scourers, bleach and sanitizer to take along to the taverna.
Victor, Nikos isn't expecting you to start work until early evening, Marigold said.
I cannot, in all conscience, work in that place until it has been thoroughly scrubbed, I replied. Perhaps you'd like to come along and help me out, since it was you that landed me in it.
You have to be joking. I've done quite enough for today, and plan to spend the afternoon curled up with a good book.
I was up at the crack of dawn, baking kurabiedes to take along to the beautifying the cemetery gathering, and then spent all morning pulling weeds out of graves, Marigold stated, sending me one of her withering looks when I choked with laughter at her delusion that she had actually baked the shop-bought biscuits. There was no sign of Nikos when I arrived at the taverna, but the door was ajar. Surmising he was busy in the fields, I took stock of my surroundings, realizing I had an insurmountable task before me in licking it into cleanliness. I began by clearing all the detritus of the previous evening's dining into bin bags and generally tidying up. Neither Nikos nor Dina seemed bothered that old newspapers littered the place, or that discarded plastic packaging from bottled water was piled randomly in dusty corners. Holding a mildewed copy of Tuvima at arm's length, I was not completely surprised to discover it was more than 3 years out of date, the headlines dating back to June 1999. The next item on my agenda was tackling Dina's kitchen. Touching with disapproval, I carried the vat of olive oil she used to fry her famous chips in outdoors, careful to throw it on the nearest patch of grass. Disposing of oil down the sink would likely cause a blockage, and I was clueless if the sewage truck that pumped the waste from the local septic tanks would be able to cope with a fatberg. It struck me that Dina probably hadn't changed the oil in the grimy and greasy fryer since the turn of the century. Next, I treated the kitchen to a vigorous scrubbing, followed by a deep sanitizing. Moving into the dining area, I swept up the detritus and then considered removing the cobwebs hanging from the ceiling. Since the mosquito season had finished, they served no useful purpose. Despite being 6 feet tall, I was unable to reach the ceiling even when I balanced on a chair. Not willing to be defeated, I took out my mobile phone and called Vangelis, the builder, to see if he could pop round and lend me a ladder. Fortunately, since Vangelis was working locally, he was round in a jiffy with the requested ladder. During the course of the work he had done on our house, Vangelis had proved to be a good friend, and we always enjoyed running into one another in the village. We often shared an evening together at the taverna, but now he was justifiably curious as to why I was up his borrowed ladder brushing the cobwebs from Nikos's ceiling. After explaining the predicament that Marigold had landed me in, Vangelis agreed that the old place could definitely benefit from a good sluicing down. The Athena no longer bothers to shower and dress up to come here to eat. She shall when she get home. She say the place make her to feel the grubby, Vangelis told me. I shared his wife's sentiments. It was always a case of dressing down when we ate at the taverna, preferably in something that was due for a wash, since the stench of fried chips clung to whatever we wore. Although Marigold bemoaned the missed opportunity to dress up for dinner, the local taverna suited me. I could enjoy a glass or two of Nikos's special Spitico wine without worrying about driving home. Since Marigold refused to learn to drive the left-hand drive Punto, I was lumbered with the role of designated driver in our marriage. You know, Victor, even with all the scrubbing, that ceiling will never come to clean. It is too blackened from the mud soot from the sobar, Vangelis pointed out. It would certainly benefit from a fresh coat of paint, I concurred. I suppose Nikos just doesn't have the time. He works in the fields all day and grills all night. He is too the busy to notice. What say you we give it a fresh coat now? I have the spare paint in the van, Vangelis suggested. By early evening, the taverna, practically gleamed with cleanliness and boasted a freshly painted orange ceiling. I wasn't too sure of the colour, but Vangelis had a job lot going spare. Anyway, it is not the orange. See, it says on the tin, "It is burnt sunshine," Vangelis said, as we stared at the now vibrant ceiling. "Well, it's definitely an improvement on soot-stained," I said, wondering if it had ever been white to begin with. "Give the greeting to the marigold. The Athena was very impressed with her Corybiades she brought along this morning. She say from now on she will bring the shop board too, rather than getting up before the dawn to do the baking," Vangelis said, with a knowing wink. With Vangelis gone, I decided to go home, shower, and catch 40 winks before returning to manage the kitchen that evening. About to leave, I suddenly remembered that I still had to peel my way through an enormous potato mountain in preparation for that evening's chips. Chapter 3. Guzim gets a new shirt. I was just stepping out of the taverna to head home for a shower and change of clothes before returning for my first evening shift as a volunteered chef, when Spiros cycled by. He was still defiantly helmetless, in spite of the rakish scar he bore from being flung over the handlebars when his bicycle had suffered an unfortunate encounter with a pothole. It appeared my frequent lectures on optimum health and safety guidelines for cyclists obviously went in one ear and out the other. "Victor, it is good to see you, my friend. What are you doing coming out of the Nikos's place at this early hour? He not start the grill until 9. After explaining my situation as a volunteered chef, having promoted myself from a kitchen skivvy, Spiros commented he expected the taverna would be very busy when word got around the village that a foreigner was working the kitchen. "I have the good news for you, Victor. I have persuaded Papas Andreas to bless your house Methavrio," Spiros declared. "Would that be Methavrio in the literal sense of the day after tomorrow, or in the more general sense of some extremely random time in the future?" I inquired. "Ah, Victor, I see you are growing the Greek sense of the humour," Spiros said, with a wink. "The papas will be there the morning of the day after the tomorrow. Be sure to have the things ready for him. He will to bring the holy water and the basil, but you must to provide the candle and the small gift for his trouble." "It's very good of him, considering that we aren't regular churchgoers, not being orthodox," I said. "I arrange it, Victor. After all, the papas know he to owe you the favour." I struggled to think of why on earth the papas should be under the impression he owed me a favour. I had seen him hurrying around the village, distinctive in his orthodox black vestment and stovepipe hat, but always in the distance and never to speak to. I had heard he was apparently a very busy man, stretching himself rather thin by overseeing churches in 3 different villages. "He is the son of your neighbour, the Kyria Maria. He is very gratified you find the way to put the stop to the mother's disgusting habit of burning the plastic daily," Spiros explained. "A habit made him feel much the embarrassment. It was a great relief to scheme up a way to stop her nasty plastic-burning habit," I said. For the first month in our new home, we had been plagued with toxic smoke wafting over from Maria's daily bonfire, a habit she had acquired during a 2-decade feud with Spiros's uncle, her neighbour before us, who had plummeted to his death from the roof. She had finally promised to put an end to the practice when I wheedled an invitation for her to a pool party thrown by Harold, a particularly obnoxious expat. Harold liked to befriend any local British or any random tourists he would trawl for in the nearest beach bars, hoping to wow them with his superior pool. He sorely regretted his move to Greece, but couldn't sell the traditional house he had ripped all the traditional features from. He had the deluded idea that Greece had tried to invade England during the war, and he kept his distance from the locals, clueless they considered him an entitled bore. He had seemingly made it his life's mission to befriend me and drag me over to admire his pool.
Curia Maria bore the ear off the anyone who will to listen about how she went to the pool party at the Foreigns. She is the only non-British person in the village to have been in the pool, Spiros said.
Harold's deluded sense of superiority has alienated most of the British, I said, delighted he had taken to snubbing me. Since Maria spoke not a word of English, and Harold and his wife Joan not a word of Greek, it had amused me greatly to watch them attempt to get the old woman out of their pool. From what I could gather, they had taken to avoiding answering their door, just in case it was Maria demanding repeat access to their precious pool.
Yes, soon he will be the desperate enough to start wanting the, how Harold say, the Greek peasants as friends. Now all you British avoid him.
Spiros chuckled. Bidding goodbye to Spiros, I continued home, stepping into the garden before heading upstairs. I immediately spotted Guzim, the Albanian, who lived in the stone shed at the bottom of the garden, helping himself to oranges from my trees. A tall fence had been erected around the stone shed to safeguard the privacy of all parties, and a hole knocked in the garden wall to provide Guzim his own access without traipsing through my garden. Nevertheless, Guzim still wandered into the garden at will, having quite obviously worked one of the wooden planks in the fence loose with this very purpose in mind. Guzim hurried over for a chat as soon as he caught sight of me, even though our level of conversing resulted in constant miscommunications. Still, at least Guzim's misunderstanding that I was a mentally defective homosexual had been cleared up satisfactorily. My increasing vocabulary allowed me to throw the odd word out in the wrong tense, and gesticulations proved quite effective. Guzim offered me one of my oranges, the fresh aroma of citrus tempting me to peel it immediately. As I savoured in the luxury of eating fruit plucked from my very own orange tree, Guzim decided to get up to his old tricks by pulling at my purse strings through my heartstrings. Tugging on his shirt sleeve to show off a ragged rip, he bemoaned, "Tenin negalo," which I translated as meaning, "no good." He then spewed out a string of indecipherable Greek. I recognized random words in his monologue, but failed to piece together money, bus, shirt, and wife into any semblance of a coherent sentence. I presumed he was telling me he couldn't afford a new shirt to replace the ripped one, since his wife in Albania ate all his money, but I failed to see where the bus came into it. Vangelis had given me clear warning that Guzim would try and manipulate me into giving him things, using the excuse he was permanently poor since he sent all his wages to his wife in Albania. Vangelis warned me that Guzim would try to take advantage of what he would perceive as a gullible rich foreigner. The builder told me not to fall for my gardener's sob stories, since he earned the going rate for his labours and drank all his wages. On this occasion, the tears coursing down Guzim's face as he ranted on about his ripped shirt did move me, even though I recognised I was being suckered. The regular work I'd given him in the garden, which supplemented his earnings from labouring, had dried up with the onset of winter. I felt a tad guilty that by reducing the days I hired him to just one day a week, I had exacerbated his pitiful poverty. Gesticulating for Guzim to wait for me in the garden, I went into the house to see if there was a suitable shirt in my wardrobe that I wouldn't miss too much. My attention was drawn to a long-sleeved T-shirt emblazoned with the slogan, "Be clean and hygienic," that Barry had gifted me one Christmas as a joke, now lying in a rumpled heap on the wardrobe floor. Although I appreciated Barry's attempt at cheap humour, I would never be caught dead in a T-shirt, being strictly a button-down kind of guy. I couldn't imagine how it had ended up in my Greek wardrobe, since I'd had a good clear-out when packing. Reaching down to remove the T-shirt, I noticed it was serving as a makeshift bed for Clawsome's new kitchens, the devil spawn of Cynthia's ugly mutant rapist Tom. Shooing the kitchens out of the wardrobe, I gave the T-shirt a brisk shake. I certainly wouldn't miss it, and Guzim was always so shabbily attired that I presumed he'd be grateful for anything, even if it was covered in cat hairs. Guzim received the shirt with exaggerated gratitude, throwing himself to the ground and clasping my knees, no doubt convinced such an effusive display would persuade me to part with my belongings on a more regular basis.
Chapter 4. Marital Chat.
Victor, have you been upsetting the new kittens again?
Marigold accused.
They may be feeling a tad upset if they overheard me saying it was time we found them good homes, I retorted.
How can you be so cold-hearted? We can't possibly separate Clawsome from her babies.
Marigold.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?